I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The Broadway musical Beautiful opened the 2018 Clues Memorial Hall season. The Tony Award-winning show tells the inspirational story of singer-songwriter Carole King. She is one of the most successful female songwriters of all time and continues a career that began in the 1960s when she was just a teenager. Now, most people are familiar with her iconic album Tapestry, a collection of songs that to this day are covered by artists in all musical genres. Well, that album was also the inspiration for writer Doug McGrath. He wrote the book, which became the story for the musical. I spent some time talking with him on the phone about the process of writing King's story and then taking it from page to stage.
I want to be a songwriter, Ma.
It's not practical. Girls don't write music.
The bulk of the story takes place when she's young, very young, 16, 18, 20, in her early years. And she falls in love with this guy, she wins this guy, and then their marriage doesn't work out, and she is heartbroken. And their partnership, their writing partnership, comes apart too. So she's lost not only her husband and the boy she loved, but her writing partner. And at 28, she thought, my whole life is over. It's all over. And the beautiful message of the show is, hang on, hold on, keep going, because when you think it's all over, it isn't. Something better is ahead. And in fact, in Carole's case, the greatest success of her career was ahead, because out of that heartbreak and struggle and the joy of being in love came Tapestry.
It's a winner!
I got a prediction.
What is it?
We're going all the way.
Number one!
She was so smart, she skipped 2 years of high school. She started college when she was 16. She had a number one hit single as a writer by the time she was 17, and a song that is so great, I have to name it. It's Will You Love Me Tomorrow. That was written by a 17-year-old girl and a 19-year-old boy, Jerry Goffin, and it's one of the greatest songs of the second half of the 20th century.
Tonight you're mine completely. You give your love so sweetly.
Her parents had been unhappily married, and when her parents divorced, it was very hard for her mother to move on. She was in a rage about her father all the time. And Carole thought, as a young girl, she thought, I don't want to be that person. If something happens, I want to be able to forgive that person and not be consumed by it.
McGrath says King is a very modest person who at first felt very awkward about having an entire show focused on some of the most poignant years of her life.
You know, she wasn't going to come see it for a long time. But then eventually she heard from so many people who loved it. They said, you've got to go see it. So she came to see it, but she came in disguise because she didn't want everybody in the audience watching her watch the show. And then at the end, she came out and surprised the cast. She took off her disguise and she came out at the curtain call. And it was fantastic.
I've been working up to coming. I haven't seen this show. This is my first night. And, you know, the word that I said backstage, I'm not going to say here, but it is effing awesome.
And when it came time to write the book, he listened to what else? Tapestry.
It has some heartbreak songs, some struggle songs, and some joyful songs. Title of the show, Beautiful, comes from the song Beautiful on that album, which is itself a joyful song.
Get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world.
I had interviewed Carole and Jerry and Barry and Cynthia at length over many days. I sat for a long time with their stories. They were all put into transcripts for me, and I sat with the stories, reading them over and over, and I listened to their music in the background. And it was funny because as I thought about their stories and the events of their lives, I would start to hear something in a song that obviously chimed with an event in their life, with some emotion, with some feeling that they must have felt at that time. So I tried to find ways to match the songs to the events and to the emotions that were that they were feeling at the time.
No, we really did try to make it.
The musical has been performed around the world for the past 4 years, and McGrath says he wouldn't change a thing about it.
You know, you feel such a conscientious responsibility to the real people in the show, but I only have 2.5 hours to tell the show, to tell their story. And about an hour of the show is music, and about 20 minutes of the 2.5 hours is intermission. So it does require a lot of compression. And of course, the other thing that I sometimes regret, but there's nothing to do about it, is there are so many great songs that they all wrote. And I think I picked the very best ones that were right for this, but oh, there are other beauties in their catalog that would be wonderful to hear as well.
My life has been a tapestry of rich and royal hue, an everlasting vision of the ever-changing view, a wondrous world.
Because Beautiful is the story of how Carole King never gave up on her dreams, WFYI hosted an event for up-and-coming musicians where they could perform a song before a panel of judges who would select one of them and give them the opportunity to be featured on WFYI's small studio session and to perform in the lobby of Clues Hall on the opening night of Beautiful. Haley Costas won that event. WFYI's Melissa Davis shares her story.
My name's Haley Costas, and I'm making original music. Original music is my preferred medium because you're creating something that wasn't there before. Music has the ability to express so many emotions, personally, I think, better than words do most of the time. And it can kind of be your best friend. It can kind of grow with you.
Heard about the way that you made your name.
So on my writing days, I will usually get up and head straight to the kitchen to make some coffee and breakfast. After my breakfast, I'll sit at the table and do a journaling exercise called Morning Pages. Morning Pages is a reference from a book called The Artist's Way. It's basically a stream of consciousness just to kind of get your mind flowing. The songs are never really done, right? The ability to not only just like a passport, like a travel stamp, music acts like that, I think. I mean, I can definitely timestamp where I was in certain stages of my life, depending on how angry the song lyrics are. But it has the ability to grow with you. Place factors into my art. Because I used to use travel and physical location as a way of running from my problems. So I was always traveling, and my problems never went away. But because of that, I've been to some beautiful places in the world. And through songwriting, I've learned that you can't really run away from your problems. They'll follow you. But for me, it was kind of a necessary thing that I needed to teach myself. And it helped me kind of get out into the world.
Fall in line, we eased in a way you can't deny. With your hand in mine, this is the work of a dangerous kind.
Indianapolis has been an amazing place for me to perform and to share my art. The amount of talent here is insane. I mean, everywhere you look, there are, and they're young now too. I mean, it's all ages, but I'm blown away. I met a girl who's 20 now, a Butler student, and she's like doing all these looping and all this stuff. And Indy, the vibe is so welcoming. I mean, she shares a little bit of her tricks with me, and we talk about music, and we're always learning from each other. And I've gotten so many opportunities just from the kindness, straight up kindness from people's hearts. What makes me keep going with my art is that I can't not. Like, I don't know what'll happen with my art. I mean, who knows, right? But I can't not express myself and get all of, you know, what I'm processing off my chest. And yeah.
I was born on the 8th of December in a far town.
The Indianapolis Motor Speedway at the corner of 16th and Georgetown in the town of Speedway was actually originally built as a testing facility for the then rapidly growing automobile industry that was taking place in Indianapolis and Indiana. Now, this was back in 1909, and at the time, state roads were mainly made from dirt. But automobile technology had advanced enough that vehicles could run much faster than those posted speed limits. So some very inventive business owners, Carl Fisher, his three partners, James Allison, Arthur Newby, and Frank Wheeler, decided that they wanted to build a motor parkway. And it would have long straightaways and gradual turns that could push an automobile to its fullest extent. Now, they're businessmen, so they also believe that the track could not only be used for private testing, but they could also have automobile racing events there, and the local auto manufacturers could race their stripped-down vehicles. The public could see those cars, and then they would want to buy those cars for their personal use from the maker's showrooms. So there you go. The Motor Speedway was built in the spring of 1909. But the first race there was actually a hot air balloon race in June. It wasn't until fall of that year that over 3 million paving bricks were laid on top of the original crushed rock and tar surface that created that 2.5-mile oval and gives it its beloved nickname, the Brickyard. Of course, 1909 was also viewed as the birth of the sport of American open-wheel car racing, which is also known now as Indy car racing. And its marquee event, the Indianapolis 500, debuted at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 1911. So you've got drivers, you've got businessmen, you've got owners, you've got businesses, you've got spectators. Everybody's in love with the area. It's thusly called the racing capital of the world. And it just sounds like the great stuff of a movie, doesn't it? And that is the cue from the snickering man
wow.
next to me. It's time for our weekly chat with Matt. It's Matthew Soucy, the host of Film Sociology on WFYI's HD2. How about that?
I have to follow that? Wow. Jeez.
But it is. It's a beloved spot and has an amazing history to it that
yes.
just in and of itself is like the American dream and hence just great fodder for film.
And neighbors would become a little more wealthier by all those cars parking in their yard for the parking thing. Yeah,
but it does. It has given us great film movies.
There's a couple that come to mind when it comes to, well, the one that was actually shot in Indianapolis was a 1969 film called Winning.
Girl, you mean out there?
Come on, move!
With Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward.
Where are you from?
Santa Monica, California.
Is that a big place?
Yeah, it's big enough. It touches Los Angeles.
Well, Redburn's a little place. People in Redburn talk just to have something to do. And I live in a house with my mother and my son. So when they talk about me, it reflects on them. I just wanted you to know I'm not easy.
Robert Wagner, a very young Richard Thomas. I interviewed Thomas many moons ago for a play that he was touring in, and I believe he said he celebrated his 19th birthday at the track. So and so there's one. It's a you know it's a 60s period piece, but you get to look at the track at that time. But yeah, that's a little piece of history. I think for me the best film involving auto racing is a film called Grand Prix, with James Garner and Eva Marie Saint. Only because it has, I think it was the first time they put a camera on the front of the car.
Oh, wow.
So it was low to the ground and had that really fast, you know, you are there feel to it. But that's one that really captures the race in itself, as opposed to the stock footage that happens with a lot of TV movies and cheaper films before that. Yeah.
There are a number of movies that do involve racing and just that whole relationship between people, and not just with the car, but with people in life in general.
Yeah, not just in sports. I tend to be more interested in the films that are about more than just will he or she win the contest. It's what happens to the person along the way. And Grand Prix is like that a little bit. Winning with Paul and Joanne, there's a romantic subplot to go with that. I think of Driven with Burt Reynolds and Sylvester Stallone, and it's well, they should have did a movie 20 years prior to that one. But there are various degrees of that. I would still stick with Grand Prix. I mean, we'll save NASCAR movies for another time in another place. But so get some real auto racing footage to get you geared up for the big race at the end of the month.
Vroom, vroom.
Yes, that too.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, looking at life through rose-colored glasses.
I like the way our golden retriever looks more golden than ever.
And taking each day one moment at a time.
It's interesting and really fun to sort of remind adults that they also have those gifts. Sometimes we're like, it's taught out of us.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Curious Mix is an audio adventure into the arts and culture taking place in our communities. To see what's going on, iPhoneographer Scott McAllister and I visit local exhibits and events on our WFYI Facebook page. We recently attended the world premiere of the new documentary Eva, which shares the story of Auschwitz survivor Eva Kaur. It's produced by Ted Green Films, Micah Brown, and WFYI TV Productions. The event took place at Clues Hall in the Butler Arts Center on the Butler University campus.
World premiere here at Butler University, which seems fitting because isn't this where you first heard Eva tell her story?
It actually is. Just about 2 years ago exactly, I had never heard of Eva Kaur. I think my first question was, what's an Eva Kaur? And my buddy said, well, you know, she's a Holocaust survivor. She's going to speak at Butler. And I said, well, all due respect, there have been a lot of Holocaust stories. He said, trust me, come and see her. I came, I was mesmerized, I decided right away I wanted to go with her to Auschwitz to learn more, and that was it. Then I was hooked.
Well, exactly. Back on that night, you see her, the light bulb goes off in your head, you have this vision, this feeling. How did you develop that, and is it what you felt that night, is that what's in the film that we're going to see?
I don't know. I mean, I think you feel my excitement at, wow, this story needs to be told, but there is so much I didn't know, and I dare say there was so much most of the public didn't know, and they will learn it. A lot of them will learn it tonight, because there was 50 years of her life, which were the hardest years of her life outside of Auschwitz, and she doesn't talk about those much, and yet she was willing to go there with us, and I give her all the credit in the world, because I think that is what humanizes her and will really develop her character, that people will see this woman and her accomplishments and her message in an entirely different light.
You're going to take the documentary to several film festivals this summer. Why is that?
Well, we feel this story is so much bigger than Indiana. I mean, this is not just a national story. This is an international story. I mean, we filmed this in about 7 countries around the world. And we think that her message is universal. And her inspiration she gives is universal. So we think that the topic alone deserves, you know, we owe it to her and the topic to take this as far as it'll go.
I think they're starting the party without you, Ted, downstairs. We're going to send you back down. Thank you. Congratulations once again. So wonderful. And another VIP is with us, too. You know, there has to be music with a documentary, and that means Dr. Tyron Cooper, musician, composer, educator. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we know you've scored music for some of Ted's other documentaries as well, but I believe you actually got to see some of the footage, didn't you, before you got too deep into the music with this one?
Yes.
What kind of difference does that make when you're scoring the music, when you get to see it first?
Well, the thing about it is, even before we score anything, you know, Ted and I talk through this film and the previous films. He's a great storyteller. So he gives you this vivid image of what the story is, the nuances of the story, before you read a script, before you see any footage. Of course, this time I had the script, I had the footage, and I had Ted. He's the definitive ingredient here, right? Because it's his story that he's telling in honor of Eva. It's Eva's story, actually, but he's the great storyteller.
Now, sometimes in documentaries, music is just kind of added in there just to move the movie along. But this time, I mean, it really becomes like a character in the movie. So how do you make that character impact, enhance the movie without becoming too melodramatic? Because the images and the people, so powerful.
Right. Well, we wanted to keep the score intimate. And so we called upon two fantastic artists, Zach DePew, who is the concertmaster for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and Marietta Simpson, Professor Marietta Simpson, who's a voice professor at Indiana University, Jacobs School of Music. And so I brought my friends in, basically, these two powerhouses who are unselfish with their gifts, because they could have done so much, but they did what was necessary to tell that story. To convey the nuances of her rich story, what she's done, what she continues to do, but in an intimate way. So wanted to be a part of the story, but not get in the way. And they knew exactly how to do that. And so we were really fortunate to have them on this score as well.
You are an educator. What lessons have you learned from being part of this documentary that you're going to share with your students?
Never complain. Eva shows us all how to live life with resilience, just a multifaceted strength. And that's, I mean, it's in all walks of life, she's been able to succeed in spite of the challenges. She showed us, never complain, you know, be flexible, be able to adapt in life, and have a vision, and you'll make it.
Eva founded the Candles Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Terre Haute. WFYI's Matt Pelser recently toured the museum with its executive director, Dorothy Chambers.
In 1995, Eva founded Candles Holocaust Museum and Education Center as a way to honor her twin sister, Miriam, who had died in 1993 from a rare form of cancer that doctors felt was most likely a consequence from the experiments that were conducted on Miriam 50 years previous, you know, at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. By creating a museum, it was also, you know, cathartic for Eva. She was able to pour her soul and her questions and her, you know, feelings into this place and educate the community about what, you know, about her life and about the Holocaust more generally. Our primary exhibit is called Choices, The Holocaust Through Eva's Story. We titled it Choices because we want visitors to know that the Holocaust wasn't inevitable. It didn't just happen on its own. It was the result of choices that individuals, groups, governments made that led to this horrific mass murder. The other thing we try to do is weave Eva's personal family story in through the history to humanize the numbers and to personalize the history. The Moses family was taken to a small ghetto/transit camp, miserable conditions. One of the most horrific camp commanders was at this Chahe ghetto. Eva's father was tortured because they were convinced that he had gold and other valuables, not understanding that he was a farmer and the value was in the land. And then after the ghetto, of course, that they were herded into cattle cars and were sent to Auschwitz as a 10-year-old. So this whole thing is we have to keep in mind that she and Miriam are 10 years old. And we have thousands of students who come to the museum every year. And she talks about that with the young ones, how, you know, she even never imagined that she would have to be so strong and such a fighter, but the strength of human spirit and human beings to survive in these conditions is really remarkable. You don't know what you have until you're tested. So this giant mural here is the front gate of Birkenau. Beyond those gates are hundreds of acres of marshland on which wooden barracks were built, just row after row after row, as far as you could see. But this front gate is where the cattle cars would come through and follow along the train track to this gravelly area called the selection platform. And this mural represents such a large part of our exhibit because this is such a large part of Eva's and many other victims' stories, because this is where their families were separated forever. So Eva talks about arriving, the confusion, the dogs, the chaos on the platform. Again, she's 10 years old. In all the confusion, she looks around and she realizes her father and Elise and Edith, her two sisters, are gone. And that's, she never saw them again. She and Miriam were holding on to Yaffa's hands, and a guard approached them yelling in German, "Twins, twins." Yaffa asked the guard, "Well, is this a good thing?" The guard said, "Yes." And so next thing they knew, or Eva knew, they were torn from her mom's hands and they were taken away. And then that was the last time that Eva saw her mom. So they were processed. The twins were housed in a separate barrack from other prisoners. There were girl twins aged 2 to about 16, and then the boy twins lived in another barrack. They began this really horrible routine of going to a blood lab 3 days a week and then going for measuring and other experiments back over at Auschwitz I the other 3 days a week. So Eva actually kept track of time because she knew on Sundays there were no tests. So she kept track of time by counting Sundays. So this whole Dr. Mengele thing was such a twisted, odd, horrible relationship, because on the one hand, he saved these children's lives. These children, so there are 3,000 Mengele twins. Most of them were children, and many of them weren't even twins. So there was nothing scientific done, regarding these experiments at all. They were brothers and sisters who looked alike. Of these 3,000, 200 survived, just to give you a sense of just the horrific experiments that these had to undergo. And there was one time when Eva became extremely ill, high fever, she broke out in spots. She was taken to what they called the infirmary, but it was actually just another barrack where people were left to die. Mengele viewed her chart, said, "This young one has 2 weeks to live." But Eva being Eva, she also said, "Well, yeah, I will be alive at the end of these 2 weeks. I'm not going to die."
So seemingly by sheer will, she survived.
Yes. When she tells her story, she talks about these silent pledges that she made at different points throughout this experience. So when she and Miriam, their first night in the twin barrack, at night they went to use the latrine. They got there. There were 3 dead bodies of children on the latrine floor. So she made her first silent pledge that she would, she and Miriam would not be among those dead bodies, that they would live. And then another silent pledge was that she would survive that. And, sheer will, determination, some luck, and she survived.
Wow.
They both survived.
So then we make it to January 1945, liberation.
Yes. So Auschwitz was liberated by the Soviets on January 27th, 1945. After liberation, Eva and Miriam were able to eventually make their way back to Romania. So Eva and Miriam were in Romania. Now, of course, communism takes hold, right? So now they're in communist Romania until 1950, at which time she and her their aunt were able to emigrate to Israel. She attended an agricultural school, and it's at this time where she really talks about feeling love, acceptance. She and Miriam joined the Israeli army. Miriam became a nurse. Eva became a draftsman. She eventually became a sergeant major in the Israeli army. So through all of this, though, they're struggling, right? In 1960, Mickey went to Israel to visit his brother, met Eva. 2 weeks later, they were married. Eva comes back to Terre Haute. So it's actually because of Mickey that we have this Holocaust Museum in Terre Haute. So they raise a family in Terre Haute, but again, just really tough time. Eva had troubles fitting in. 70s and 80s were difficult in Terre Haute. Halloween was especially bad. Some of the young neighbors would throw things at the house, and Eva wasn't one to just let it happen. She would go out and chase or do things that would actually, looking back, would make things worse. And so it was a really difficult time. Now, in 1978, NBC aired a documentary, and we start, so this leads into this whole path of forgiveness. So there was this documentary with Meryl Streep and James Woods, which I haven't seen yet. It was called The Holocaust. And apparently, in the late 70s, this was how America found out about the Holocaust.
And the late 70s.
It was 1978.
Wow.
I know. So this docudrama began to open Americans' eyes as to what happened. Locally here, Terre Haute, the local affiliate, aired it. Eva heard about this, so she called the station and said, well, do you know, is there going to be footage as part of this? And they said, well, you know, like, why do you want to know about it? She said, well, I was there. And then all of a sudden now people began to understand who Eva was or just what she was and what she, you know, where she came from, what her story was. Mm. They invited her down to the station. She shared her story on air. So late 70s now, early 80s, she began to share her story. Mm. In 1993, right, Miriam had just died. Eva was invited to speak at a conference about Nazi medicine in Boston. And this professor asked her to bring a Nazi doctor, which takes a lot of guts to ask, I think. And so she said that, and that's a classic Eva quote. Where am I going to find a Nazi doctor? Last time I looked, they were not advertising in the yellow pages. But, okay, so, which, absolutely, right? And why would she know a Nazi doctor, right?
Exactly.
But yet, she did. So, because she recalled that she, one of the last projects that she and Miriam worked on involved this doctor named Hans Munch. So she was able to contact him and asked him if he would come with her to Boston. And he said no, but that he would meet with her. So she goes to his house, and he treats her with kindness. And for some reason, she just decided to ask him if he knew anything about the gas chambers. And he actually did have information on the operation of the gas chambers. And he was able to provide, and he was willing to sign a statement detailing the some of the routines with recording deaths and things like that, that no one had known about at the time. And he agreed to go with her to Auschwitz in 1995 and to sign the statement on the selection platform. So Eva wanted to thank him for this. She decided to write him a letter to say that she forgave him. And when she wrote the letter, she knew that it would help him, but what she didn't realize was the effect it had on her personally. And by putting on paper that she could forgive him, her pain, all this pain that she had been carrying, was lifted. It's all about gaining control over your life or regaining control, knowing that you have the power to say, you cannot affect my life anymore. I have the right to be free. I have the right to be this tremendous human being with potential that, you know, and she never had that before. You know, from the time she was separated from her family till that time in 1995. Her choice to forgive, as you can imagine, is incredibly controversial. There are very few survivors who will say they understand why she did this. They, on the contrary, worry that by forgiving, you are sort of letting the Nazis off the hook. And by no means is that what she thinks. It's a way of removing yourself from being a victim and releasing yourself from this burden. Eva's point is no one will ever get the satisfaction of an apology or anything from the Nazis, right? But why should you still be tied to them? You deserve to be free from that. So as she says, it's free, right? It doesn't cost you anything. And if you don't like it, you can go back to being a victim. But it is this doable, accessible process that she offers people. I mean, she gets emails and letters every week from people who say, I was heading down this path of personal destruction, and I am now turning a corner because of you. So this message of forgiveness is different from other Holocaust museums. We very much want people to reflect. We don't push this on people, but we hope that visitors will leave with a lot to think about, but a sense of hope, there can be a path forward. That gives the museum a little bit of a different tone. Hang on, let me introduce you to Eva. Hey, Eva, can I introduce you to someone from WFYI? This is Matt Pelzer. This is Eva Kaur.
Hi, Eva.
I just talked to Israel, and the reporter, she said, well, aren't you angry with the Nazis? I said, and if I am going to be angry, will that make me happy? Am I going to feel better? The Nazis are long gone. Those, they died or they don't care. Mm-hmm. They don't know that I am angry. I am the only one now that I am.
So what good is that going to do?
Yeah. And I said, you tell me what really makes me sad, that 73 years after we were liberated from Auschwitz, most of my fellow Auschwitz survivors or other survivors are angry. They are the only ones that they are angry. Their children, maybe their grandchildren, but the Nazis didn't care then, and they surely don't care now. And she said, oh. I said, fine, if I am angry, what will happen? Will any Nazi get hurt by it?
No.
Well, it was wonderful to meet you. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
Today.
Nice meeting you, too.
And take care.
Have a nice tour. You're a good
hand. Oh, I know it.
Thanks, Eva.
Keep listening as Curious Mix continues. A school where there is no limit on age, crafts, or laughs? Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez takes us to Line and Form in Irvington.
At the beginning of class, we always have a warm-up. We always just draw. Last week, we had some chalk pastels out, so just even just providing different materials for them each week. Once we are finished with our warm-up, we go over to our main project, which today is cardboard sculptures.
It's coloring time at Line and Form Atelier in Irvington. Studio owner and instructor Fran Samaripa is leading her three preschool-age students, Cecilia, Corbin, and Julian, in a scribble session with dot markers and quick sticks. Papers show every color imagined, some as polka dots across the pages and some pulled together into blobs. Freestyle is the name of the game here.
The studio is Reggio inspired, which is a philosophy of education from Reggio Emilia, Italy. Basically views a child as a whole human. So they have already come equipped with all of the skills that they would need, and it's our job as a teacher to facilitate and help bring out their innate creativity and their gifts that they're naturally born with.
The group meets weekly for one-hour sessions. Each session, grouped by age, allows the participants to explore the provided art supplies as they wish. Samaripa will lead the class with prompts, but the end results are all from the minds of the artists. For this class, several moms watch from the sidelines.
She allows the kids to kind of do what they want, and she lets them kind of lead their own path in what they're creating, and it's not so structured like more like preschool is, where they're more apt to be learning certain things. Here it's just kind of whatever they want to do, she lets them do.
Julian's mom, Donnie Waltman, says these classes have helped him prepare for the arrival of his little brother, Gavin.
And not only are they learning to create and kind of opening their mind that way, for us, for him, it was more of a social thing. He was our only child for a while, so it's allowed him to kind of learn how to work with other kids and talk to them and share. So they're learning a lot more than just kind of painting and creating things.
Can I have some orange?
Yes, you may. Would you like the quick stick or the dot marker?
The dot.
Okay, both. So here's the dot marker. So when I set out materials or a provocation, I might have an idea in mind of how those materials could or should be used. But then when I sit them down at the table, I'm not instructing them, like, this is how we are going to use this. We want them to really try it out for themselves. Absolutely. So even the art that they're making is subjective, but also the materials that we're presenting is as well. So like how those can be used, we want them to kind of push those boundaries and make those mistakes, because that's like how we learn, right?
Sam Aripa says that learning through art is a beautiful partnership with literacy and science. It's strengthening skills while thinking creatively. And these sessions here are different than a school's usual art class curriculum.
The art classes that they have in school are more guided. You know, we're learning the technical, technical skills. Where here, while we do that to an extent, it's so process-based and open-ended that they're really getting that creative freedom that most of them say they don't get in school. So it's kind of that opportunity for the older students to come and just create as if we want them to feel like this is their studio, like they have their own space to use materials and to, you know, get messy and not have to have that directed art, you know, experience.
Actually, I'm making a house. Hey, this would be perfect for my house.
I need a square.
These kinds of sessions aren't just for kids. Sam Aripa hosts adult workshops similar to wine and canvas parties, but with less of a rigid plan.
I always tell people we're basically the exact opposite of that. So while we may be, learning technique and terminology and learning about materials, it's still very open-ended. I never want my... That's beautiful, Corbin. Thank you. I never want my adult workshops to feel like everybody has to create a certain thing and it has to look a certain way at the end of the workshop.
Corbin's mom, Stacy Settle, has attended the adult workshops.
Oh, it's just nice and relaxing because it's usually just me. I went with my mom with another one, but it's just time for yourself, which is nice. It's a bit more creative than just like arts and craft time that you might like the wine and canvas stuff like that. I mean, that has its place and everything, but here it's, you know, there's something that you truly get to create, and if you have questions, she'll guide you.
For the adults to get unstuck, that process can be more intimidating than with the kids.
I just say make a mark. Like, and it's the same thing I tell the kids. Like, sometimes it's best, you know, a white piece of paper or a white canvas can be intimidating.
Maybe I might need a little more torque.
It is not a real
now there's sort of, there's some purple.
It's interesting and really fun to sort of remind adults that they also have those gifts. Sometimes we're like, it's taught out of us. I had a group of teachers in preschool teachers, and we did a project, a collaborative project, and it was just so neat to see them use materials in different ways from what they're used to using them, and just in such a laid back manner, you know, and they were just so many laughs and just having so much fun with it. So it's nice to be reminded that, you know, it's really supposed to be fun. The creative process is fun. Of course it can be frustrating, but learning how to work through that even as an adult is really important.
We have a giggly bunch.
Like creativity, there's no age limit on laughter and giggle fits. I'm Joy Hernandez for Curious Mix.
How can a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
Here's a poem by Jeffrey Harrison from his book Into Daylight. It's called Vision. I just got back from the eye doctor who told me I need bifocals. She put those drops in my eyes that dilate the pupils so everything has that Vaseline on the lens glow around it. And the page I'm writing on is blurred and blinding, even with these sunglasses. I'm waiting for the reversing drops to kick in. Sounds like something from Alice in Wonderland. But meanwhile, I like the way our golden retriever looks more golden than ever. The way the black-eyed Susans seem to break out of their contours, dilating into some semi-visionary version of themselves. And even the mail truck emanates a white light, as if it might be delivering news so good I can't even imagine it. Of course, it's just bills, catalogs, and an issue of Time magazine full of pictures of a flooded New Orleans that I have to hold at arm's length to make out. A twisted old woman, sprouting plastic tubes, lies with others on an airport conveyor belt like unclaimed luggage. And there's a woman feeding her dog on an overpass as a body floats below. Maybe we need some kind of bifocals to take it all in. The darkness and the light, our own lives and lives of others, suffering and joy, if it is out there, or something more like the compound eyes of these crimson dragonflies patrolling the yard, each lens focused on some different facet of reality. and linked to a separate part of the brain. We would probably go crazy. In my own eyes, with our single flawed lenses, the drops have almost worn off now, and my pupils are narrowing down, adjusting themselves to their diminished vision of the world.
Why did you like this one so much?
I love this one because it talks about looking, seeing the world in a different way. And that's what excites me in my creativity in my art, when I can somehow see something for the first time a little bit different. It gets me excited. And wouldn't it be great if we could see the world as saturated and exciting as this guy is with these drops in his eyes?
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another poem to help us see the world more clearly. If you're looking to perk up your palate, you might appreciate some help from Yelp, the online community where ordinary eaters recommend the tastiest places in town. Yelpers love ethnic eats, including the Middle Eastern-style bread called chapati. It's produced at the restaurant of the same name.
My name is Shani, and we own this place, Chapati, and I'm the main chef of chapati. We make flour and put little salt, oil, and make with the water, soak with the water, and then we leave dough at least half an hour to settle down, and then we make balls, and then we do with the rollers, just like, you know, people make pizza, but the chapati is very thin. And we have to make a little big with our hands too. Things on the fire, we call tawa. We put on the tawa and just for a second, and the color is changed, then we turn other side and leave a little more than a second. And we saw the bubbles on it, then we change again the side. But we cannot leave chapati too long on the tawa. So then it's soft. If we leave too long, so it's going to be very hard. So the process is very quick, fast. Then we remove from there and try to put somewhere which is airtight or cover it. Chapati we serve with the food, you know, like gravy, like thin, our dishes like dal, or it's good with the vegetarian dishes and meat with the gravy items. People love it.
Chapati is located at 4930 Lafayette Road in Indianapolis. We hope you've enjoyed listening to our curious mix of stories, but we have one more for you that will require your ears and your eyes.
You shouldn't have any trouble finding tonight's target. It's one of the brightest stars in the sky. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. Arcturus has been observed as long as humans have looked up. Ancient Polynesians used it to navigate to Hawaii. Mesopotamians linked it to the god Enlil. Ancient Romans thought the star warned of stormy weather, which makes sense because it's a prominent evening star in the springtime. It's even mentioned in some translations of the Bible. The book of Job, chapter 38, verse 32 of the King James reads, "Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons?" To find it, look high to the east right after sundown. That bright orange-white star, that's Arcturus. Arcturus is so bright, it can be observed in the daytime. The French astronomer and mathematician Jean-Baptiste Morin located it with a telescope one afternoon in 1635, but I wouldn't recommend trying it yourself. Arcturus is bright for a number of reasons. For one, it's big. It's just slightly more massive than our sun, but it's in a different stage of life. It's a red giant, which means it's burned through all of the hydrogen at its core, so it's 25 times larger than the sun, and 170 times brighter. It's also pretty close, less than 37 light years away. This also makes it a popular setting for science fiction. It's been mentioned in Buck Rogers, Superman, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and many other stories. If you see Arcturus tonight, maybe you'll be inspired to write a little stellar fan fiction. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy skywatching.
Curious Mix is made possible in part by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Brandon Meeks composed our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Joy Hernandez,
Matt Pelser,
Scott McAllister,
Matthew Zosi,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.